History in Havana on a special edition of The World. I'm Carol Hills. A sitting U.S. president is in Cuba for the first time in decades. But some Cuban dissidents didn't want President Obama to come. This one protested, and Cuban authorities made him pay the price.
They are pushing. In my case, they break one of my finger. They have been doing this kind of thing frequently.
Yet in Miami, some Cuban Americans think it's good the president is there, as long as he delivers this message to the Cuban people.
It's up to them to bring the changes about in Cuba, and that what they have to do is to understand that the state should work for them and not they working for the state.
The president's trip to Cuba, that's ahead on The World. Historic scenes and sounds in Cuba today on the first full day of President Obama's visit to Havana. Obama paid a formal visit to Havana's Revolution Square to lay a wreath at the tomb of a Cuban independence hero. Hard to imagine that even just a couple of years ago. Then the president held a joint press conference with Cuban leader Raul Castro, as I heard from my BBC colleague in Havana, Will Grant.
That joint press conference was absolutely extraordinary for those of us who are normally based here. We've never seen something like that where Raul Castro is prepared to take questions from the gathered journalists. And you could see that he was very uncomfortable in doing that. He was fiddling with his earphones. He wasn't prepared to admit that Cuba had political prisoners of any description. He said that if a list was given to him, they'd be released by the evening. So he was in competitive mood. But it was a very, very interesting event just to see the two men stand side by side. And of course, it came after all of that symbolism earlier in the day where President Obama laid a wreath at the memorial for José Martí, Cuba's independence hero.
Were Cuban journalists able to ask Raul Castro questions or just the foreign press?
No, there was a Cuban journalist asking questions too, but that tends to be a bit of a softball for President Castro. He tends to get the question he's expecting. Beyond that, it was just very, very interesting to see him address the world's press, to take that step, which we understand was encouraged by the Americans, to talk to the gathered media, because obviously there's so many people who've come here, and the US media directed two or three questions to him, and he certainly, I don't think, will be doing it again in a hurry.
And what was Obama's message at this press conference?
Well, in a sense, both men were trying to underline just how much ground they've covered over the past 15 months, but also how much still separates them, specifically on human rights and democracy. So President Castro spoke about Guantanamo Bay, about the U.S. economic embargo on Cuba, and understandably, President Barack Obama said that more can be done in Cuba on freedom of speech and human rights. We know that these are the positions of the two governments, but they were also at pains to show how far they'd come, and there was a mention of everything really, from the reinstating of direct mail between the two countries to the fact that there are going to be so many more commercial flights coming to Cuba from the United States. So I think there was a mixture really of positive, of optimism, but also realism in there too. They know that they remain very, very far apart on a lot of key questions.
We're going to be hearing from a dissident in just a minute, and I'm curious what you've been hearing from ordinary Cubans about Obama's visit.
Well, by and large, they welcome it. I don't think anyone could deny that they don't. This is something that's been decades in the waiting. So many Cubans never thought they'd live to see the day. So that the fact that the serving U.S. president is finally on the island is a moment of great excitement for most Cubans. I'm sure the dissident community are angry about certain moments of this visit, that they don't feel that they've been properly represented. But by and large, most Cubans aren't dissidents, and they're simply celebrating the fact that President Obama and President Castro appear to have been able to turn a page on some of the worst moments of their shared history.
The BBC's Will Grant in Havana. Thanks so much, Will.
Very welcome.
Cuban officials don't appear to be relaxing their ban on anti-government marches or rallies during Obama's visit. Yesterday, just before the president landed in Havana, a group of dissidents put that to a test. They gathered at a church in a suburb of Havana called Miramar. Cuban authorities cracked down even as foreign reporters looked on. Police detained several dissidents. Antonio Rodiles was among them. He was released hours later. Rodiles is also among the dissidents invited to meet with Obama tomorrow. Earlier, he described what happened when police swooped down on his group.
They are pushing. In my case, they break one of my finger. And in the case of the woman, they use also to beat in their bodies. And they don't have limit.
After you were arrested, what did the government accuse you of?
They don't say anything. They say that we cannot do this kind of activities, and they arrest, and that's it. They don't have any real justification to stop us, but they can do, because here in Cuba, they are the law. They can do whatever they want, and nobody can replay what they are doing.
I know you're meeting with President Obama tomorrow, along with some other activists. What do you plan to say to him?
Well, I think that the situation that we are living now in Cuba is really critical. The Cuban regime is taking advantage of that, and they are behaving more aggressive, more violent. And at the same time, what they are doing is to transfer the power to the family. They clearly want to transfer the power to the son of Raúl Castro, the daughter of Raúl Castro. And even the son-in-law of Raúl Castro is the one that now is controlling the economy, the companies that can make business with foreign companies.
You are saying that the Cuban government right now, you think it's just going to continue. The aging group of leaders like Raúl Castro will simply pass on power to his son or son-in-law.
Yes, I think that they have been really clear. They have been telling that they are not going to move even 1 millimeter. And this situation is not just for the political and civil right. This is also with economic freedom. They don't want that the regular people can have a small business. They just want a license, and the government can remove the license anytime, and they don't have the property right. They don't have legal entity.
Do you think it was right of President Obama to go to Havana?
I don't think that this is the good moment to come here, but even though he's here right now, I think that he needs to take advantage about this trip, and he needs to talk clearly about what is happening inside of Cuba and what they want for the future.
Do you think there's a lot of Cubans who agree with you? From here, at least, we don't get news or we don't hear of large dissident or democracy activist demonstrations. What sort of support do you and the other activists have in Cuba?
No, we have a lot of support. The point is that people are too afraid. They don't want to talk. They can confiscate your property. They can confiscate your goods, and your family can be repressed, and your sons can be expelled from the schools and all this kind of thing. You are not going to support the opposition openly because you are afraid. But at the same time, here in Cuba, everybody want a real change. They want freedom. The people in the street are speaking openly really more than before, but they are afraid because of the repression. You can see yesterday the image of what they do to the people that try to exercise their rights.
What about the argument that more American tourists, more American businessmen and women, more direct engagement could do more in the long run to help human rights and democracy in Cuba than keeping up a distance and not engaging?
The facts say the opposite thing. We see that the regime is more aggressive. We see that the regime is more violent. And also, I will ask, engagement with who? Because here, the companies are completely controlled by the military people. Then with who you are going to make business? It's going to be with the same elite that is repressing the people.
Antonio Rodiles is among the Cuban activists who were detained by authorities in Havana yesterday. He'll be meeting with President Obama tomorrow at an event for civil society leaders. Thank you so much, Antonio.
Thanks to you.
There's no shortage of opinions on President Obama's trip to Cuba, especially in Miami, home to many Cuban exiles and Cuban Americans. But opinions there are definitely more varied than they used to be. We sent the world's Jason Margolis to South Florida to get some reaction.
I put a very basic question to Cuban Americans in Miami. Should President Obama be in Cuba? Predictably, here's a liberal reaction.
Yes, I think the president going to Cuba serves tremendous interest of the administration and its policies.
and a conservative view.
I think geopolitically is a very concerning thing.
That was Mauricio Claver Caron, director of the U.S.-Cuba Democracy PAC. The first voice was Joe Garcia. He's a former Democratic congressman from South Florida. He's running this year to reclaim his seat. This being Miami, I met both in cafes. Let's start with Democrat Joe Garcia. He says the two leaders, Barack Obama and Raul Castro, present a stark symbolic contrast that the U.S. can use to its advantage.
Here you have a young American president. He's vibrant, charismatic, tall, racially looks like the Cuban people, standing next to the successor to the lifetime tenure or family possession of the Castros, older, an economy in shambles.
Claver Caron sees a much different symbolic moment unfolding.
I understand the debate of whether he can go and have, you know, a Reagan tear down the wall moment, but my argument has always been that Reagan made that argument in West Berlin, not in East Berlin, while he was hugging Erich Honecker, who was the dictator of East Germany at the time.
He adds that Obama's visit to Cuba is doing a disservice to the Cuban people.
The president, in an interview that he gave in December of 2015, essentially had made the case that he would not go to Cuba until he saw tangible evidence that human rights had improved on the island. Well, thus far, we saw last year there was 9,000 political arrests, and 2016 has been the most repressive new year in decades. And yet the president's going.
Joe Garcia sees something else happening on the island. He had a hand in shaping the Obama administration's less restrictive approach toward Cuba.
Today, you have a vibrant and growing civil society. This policy is successful. Is it exactly what we want? Is Cuba a thriving, Western European democracy? No, of course not. But certainly it's better today than it was a decade ago.
After meeting with the two men, I admit to being confused. Which guy was spinning me? Is Cuba more open than ever or more oppressive?
The truth is probably somewhere down the middle.
Eduardo Gamarra is a professor of Latin American politics at Florida International University. He says the left and the right are exaggerating the good and the bad unfolding in Cuba today. He says the administration's lifting of restrictions on Cuba is clearly having positive impacts on Cuba's civil society.
But I don't think we should exaggerate the impact of that, you know, especially on other areas. I mean, are human rights violations continuing? Absolutely. Are they likely to continue in the near future? Yes. And the exile community in Miami is right to be critical of that. And so the question is, should we continue to engage with them despite these violations?
Mauricio Claver Caron says no. He says the U.S. engaged with Latin American dictatorships in past decades, and it didn't work.
I think one of the most concerning aspects of this trip is that this is going to be the first U.S. president to visit a Latin American dictatorship since Lyndon Johnson went to visit Anastasio Somoza in Nicaragua. There's a reason why American presidents haven't done that since, because we've been in a process of democratization, which has been our geopolitical priority in the Western Hemisphere, and a successful one.
Claver Caron would like to see President Obama paying more attention to democratically elected leaders in the region. Joe Garcia believes contact in Cuba will foster change.
Probably a hug is much more powerful than a slight.
Despite the disagreements, it's worth remembering, Cuban Americans on the left and the right want the same thing: the end of a repressive regime in Cuba. That much they can agree on. For The World, Jason Margolis, Miami.
We've got a lot more later in the show on President Obama's historic visit to Havana. Plus, we've got more stories online about Cuba and the changes in the U.S.-Cuba relationship, from large-scale issues like human rights all the way down to who owns the naming rights for Cuban rum. You can read about it at PRI.org/Cuba. You're listening to The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills in Boston, and Marco Werman is in San Diego at the studios of KPBS. Hey, Marco.
Hey, Carol. Greetings from the West Coast.
Marco, the West Coast must feel kind of far from Cuba, which is the subject on our show today. Of course, President Obama is there. But we thought it'd be interesting for you to point out the difference in how Cubans come to this country from the many Latinos who come, many of whom end up in Southern California.
It's a great point, Carol. I mean, the biggest difference for Cubans anyway, their wet foot, dry foot policy. Basically, if you land in the U.S., you stay in the U.S. That's the deal.
And if you're intercepted at sea, you're sent back to Cuba. But the wet foot, dry foot policy, it's got to feel like an unfair privilege to other Latinos.
No, it does, for sure. And it hurts even more knowing that deportation of immigrants is still at record highs, close to 500,000 people just last year. Now, in the past, a portion of those deportations, in some years as much as half, were convicted criminals. But now the number of non-criminal deportations is growing, and we're seeing more moms and kids crossing the border into the U.S. That's prompted a growth in the sanctuary church movement. Sanctuary churches are exactly that, houses of worship where undocumented people can go who fear deportation. And Carol, I visited one of them, the United Methodist Church in North Hills, which is smack dab in the center of the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles. Let me take you back to Palm Sunday Mass yesterday. It began around 6:30 in the morning, about 60 people in a procession around the church grounds and into the street.
Este es el día, este es el día que hizo el Señor, que hizo el Señor.
North Hills is a pretty tough part of Los Angeles. Gang violence, especially Latino gangs, was rampant here through the 1990s. The LAPD managed to bring some of it under control. Bad stuff still happens, though. A year ago, gang violence most likely led to a fatal shooting in the parking lot of the church itself. Yesterday, on Palm Sunday, the mood was light, though. There was a strong turnout of talented musicians. The congregation waved their palm fronds, and people seemed relaxed and happy. But Pastor Fred Morris began his sermon with an ominous note.
No abra la puerta.
No abra la puerta. Don't open the door. He said it several times in Spanish and English, and the congregation, largely Latino, knew exactly what he was talking about.
If somebody comes and pounds on your door at 6 in the morning and says, "We're the police," you don't have to open your door.
Morris is the pastor at the United Methodist Church in North Hills, has been here for a year and a half. This church, the sanctuary, the community, all of this is his mission. He came out of retirement for it, urged on by an old friend, a Latina bishop.
I was living in a hammock in Nicaragua, enjoying my retired status. She asked me and my wife to come here and start a new faith community in this place.
He's been reminding his flock of their constitutional rights when agents from ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, might one day come knocking on their door.
If you open the door, they go in at gunpoint. If you don't open your door, they cannot come in.
Pastor Morris's advice has been useful to many in his congregation, including one family from Mexico who did not open their door when ICE agents paid a visit. That was last Wednesday, but moments after ICE departed, the father had to leave the house to take his daughter to school. That's when ICE pulled him over. Pastor Morris told the congregation about it at Mass.
Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency, which is the largest police force in the United States, arrested one of our neighbors across the street over here, leaving his wife and two children. He is in a detention center in Victorville and is going to have to be dealing with deportation order. Esta semana, el miércoles.
That man, David Gonzalez, was detained. I met his wife, Beatriz Orduña Abarca, and we spoke about her husband's situation.
Ya a los pocos minutos él me vuelve a llamar.
Beatriz said he was taken in because he was using a fake driver's license, but she hasn't heard much else. She doesn't know whether he'll be allowed to stay here or deported back to Mexico after living in the United States 16 years. One detail she's confused by is whether her husband is also being held on a years-old domestic abuse charge that she says had been cleared up. Pastor Morris has been trying to get them a lawyer, but as Morris told me, pro bono immigration lawyers are maxed out. As I spoke about all this with Beatriz, her 9-year-old daughter Lindsay sat close to her, the girl who was in her dad's car when ICE detained him last week. In the parking lot nearby, a weekly swap meet was happening. I asked Beatriz about what's been hardest without her husband around.
En todo. Él es el que se encargaba de los gastos de la casa, renta, biles.
Everything, she says, everything. Rent, bills, food. And then she gets to a point where it's just too much to talk about anymore. There's been a history in California of churches offering sanctuary to undocumented immigrants. Here's Pastor Fred Morris again.
Back in the 80s, there were several hundred churches became sanctuary churches, primarily for Salvadoran refugees.
Many Mexicans come from rural places where there are no jobs to go back to if they're deported, so they're desperate to stay here. And Central Americans even more so. Gangs, especially in El Salvador, are ravaging their towns. Gangs that, as Pastor Morris pointed out, ironically got their start in Los Angeles and then exported their brutality back to Central America when the LAPD began getting them deported in the 1990s.
And so they deported hundreds, if not thousands, of Salvadorans, Hondurans, and Guatemalans, gang members, back to their countries. Well, these kids got off the airplane. They had no skills. They hadn't finished school. The only thing they knew how to do was to run a gang, and they were very good at that.
And that's why so many unaccompanied minors have been fleeing Central America and making their way to the U.S. ICE has targeted a lot of them since the beginning of this year. ICE has said it wants to send a message that they cannot come here and just stay. But for a lot of Central Americans, going back is an option that's too dangerous. It's also why Pastor Morris gave his church in North Hills sanctuary status.
I don't feel we're at risk here at all because I don't think ICE is going to want to break down the doors of the church on camera for Telemundo and Univision. I think that's too heavy for them. They're not going to do it. But we're waiting now for a family willing to come in here and be our guests until we can appeal their deportation order and get it reversed. But then the problem is to get a case where the family is willing to go into voluntary incarceration in our church. Because once they come in here, they can't leave until we get the court case solved.
That's how worried members of his congregation are about deportation. Even going to the protection of a sanctuary church feels perilous, since it means openly declaring your undocumented status. Many are just not going to do that. No one has asked for sanctuary yet, including Beatriz and her kids from Mexico, who are now without a dad and husband. But Pastor Morris is keeping busy all the same, finding lawyers for this community in dire straits, raising money to help families left behind when there is a detention or deportation, keeping on message about knowing your constitutional rights, and trying to keep a sense of humor through the whole thing.
We're going to sing now the hymn that's in the bulletin. It's Un Largo Camino. This is in Spanish. If you don't know Spanish, make it up. Let's stand as we sing.
For the World, Marco Werman, Los Angeles.
Earlier, we heard about a different treatment reserved for Cuban immigrants and the wet foot, dry foot policy. It allows Cubans who make it here to stay, but it's not that simple. If you're nodding right now, go to PRI.org and quiz yourself on how much you actually know about Cuban immigration. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. President Obama meets Cuban leader Raul Castro in Havana. To some Cubans, it's a sign of positive change. To others, it's a betrayal.
To me, it seems that the current setup treats Cuba like an equal partner in these talks, and it's not. It's a tyrannical communist regime who abuses its own people.
That's coming up on The World.
Support for this podcast comes from Wonder Capital. What if you could help combat global climate change and make money at the same time? You can. Introducing Wonder Capital, the leading online investment platform where individuals can invest in large-scale solar projects across the U.S. Earn up to 11% annually while diversifying your portfolio, curbing pollution, and combating climate change. And Wonder Capital doesn't take any fees for investing your money. Join thousands who are already investing. Create an account for free at wondercapital.com/theworld. That's Wonder with a U. Wonder Capital. Do well and do good.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. President Obama's historic trip to Cuba is all about change. And how's this for change? The the U.S. national anthem playing today at an official ceremony in Havana in honor of the president's visit. It's not too far-fetched to say that many older Cubans probably thought they'd never live to hear that. Maybe some younger Cubans thought that, too. But when it comes to the complicated relationship between the U.S. and Cuba, different generations tend to see things very differently. Not just here in the U.S., but also in Cuba. Jorge Duany directs the Cuba Research Institute at Florida International University. He sees a split in Cuba between an older generation rooted in the revolution and still holding on to power, and younger Cubans who just want a better life.
For the younger generation, people in their 20s and 30s, they never experienced, you know, life before the revolution. All they have experienced has been this period of very difficult economic challenges. Many of them had not been able to find jobs in an economy that now relies primarily on tourism and remittances. In fact, we see a lot of young people in their 20s and 30s just looking for a chance to leave the island, to migrate, because that's where they see that they can chase their dreams.
I know you left Cuba as a child. Have you been able to travel back over the years?
Yes, I've been traveling to Cuba since 1981, first as a graduate student, then as a professor, and oftentimes just to visit family that remained behind.
What are the most noticeable changes you've seen over those decades of travel to Cuba?
Well, this last trip, I saw some things that changed and some things that remain pretty much the same. The changes that I saw have to do with the economy and especially with the growth of the private sector in Cuba. This is called the non-state sector or self-employment. So, for instance, in construction, all of a sudden I see people throughout Havana neighborhoods rebuilding and painting and remodeling, things that were very difficult to find, building materials, for even 4 years ago. A lot of people were converting their houses to guest houses or to private restaurants, which again is another major change that I noticed. The transportation, I think, is a little better. For instance, I was able to travel widely around the city using the most popular system, which is called boteros, and these are private taxi cabs that use the old vintage American cars, and they will, you know, pack five or six people, and on a fixed route will take you close to where you're going. And that's the most economical way to move and also the most convenient one, because otherwise you'd have to take a public bus and be, you know, an overcrowded and very hot environment and that kind of thing.
Professor Duany, what would you most like to see change there?
What I would like to see in the future on a personal level is the opening up of family relations, something that has affected my own family for as long as I can remember. And I think, you know, this kind of healing process between those who stayed behind and those who left, some of whom perhaps are impossible to reconcile. I mean, there are, of course, political differences, but also the fact that people like myself were forced to leave at a very young age. And so we keep going back trying to find our roots and our past in a country that's no longer ours. But I think it would be wonderful for both sides to be able to slowly and gradually reconcile with each other, accepting the differences and respecting each other's points of view.
Jorge Duany is from Cuba. He directs the Cuban Research Institute at Florida International University. Thanks, Professor Duany.
You're welcome.
There's a generational divide among Cuban Americans in Miami, too. Older Cuban exiles are typically opposed to any opening to Cuba's communist regime, while younger Cuban Americans tend to be more open to a new relationship with Havana. But there are voices in South Florida that defy those neat stereotypes. Take former Radio Martí commentator Uve de Aragon. Like Duany, she was born in Cuba before the revolution and moved to the U.S. as a teenager in 1959. You'd think she'd be dead set against President Obama's visit, but she's actually happy Obama is there right now.
The mere image of this young Afro-American president with a aging Raúl Castro is a message of hope for the Cuban people. I'm pretty sure the president will say something about human rights or will meet with some dissidents. But I think there's a message that's even more important for him to give to the Cuban people, which is that it's up to them to bring the changes about in Cuba. And that what they have to do is to understand that the state should work for them and not they working for the state.
She sees hope in Obama's visit to Havana. Contrast that with Ariana Mendez, a young Republican in South Florida. Her family had close ties to the pre-revolution Batista government and was blacklisted in Cuba until they were able to leave in the 1980s. Mendez was born in the U.S., but still carries the family's disdain for the Castro regime. And she's definitely not happy about Obama's visit.
It's disappointing. It really is. To a certain extent, I feel betrayed. I see this reapproachment as a reward to the Castro regime. We are a country that claims to support human rights and democracy around the world, and here we are. We're going to extend a hand, extend an olive branch to a regime that has made no attempts whatsoever to change their ways. They continue to be as adamant, as communist, as tyrannical as they were in 1959. So for me, it's unmerited. We have a situation where Cuba has made no promise of changes, and President Obama is rewarding that continued bad behavior with such a visit of such a caliber. It's very disappointing.
There have been some changes over the years. You know, it's small, but there is a sector of people having renting their apartments out, having restaurants. There's steps that have been taken. People can travel more easily to visit relatives in Cuba. Aren't those some steps toward positive change?
I see those as purely cosmetic. With the death of Chavez in Venezuela, and as Venezuela provided oil subsidies to Cuba and was a great economic benefactor to the communist regime on the island, after Chavez passed away and those resources were no longer readily available, Cuba felt in need of desperation. They needed to stimulate the economy some way, somehow. It's not because they believe these changes are good. It's not because they want Cubans to be able to open their small businesses. It's because of necessity, of desperation. And instead of lessening restrictions and having this reapproachment, this would have been the ideal time to really force the issue and have them concede ground on human rights, on economic reforms, and have something meaningful in exchange for all these travel restrictions and lessening of regulations between the U.S. and Cuba.
What about the argument that President Obama and others have put forward that for 50 years, there's been no progress either, and that a way to bring about change is actual engagement and a constructive dialogue between Washington and Havana?
But here's the thing. Engagement means that you have two parties coming to the table. In this case, I think it's just the United States extending the olive branch. It's not Cuba is not promising anything in return for this olive branch. It has not said that they will make reforms. After the reapproachment was announced, Raul Castro went on Cuban television and said that Cuba will continue to be a socialist state, that there was no turning back, that there was no change to that. So the recalcitrant attitude, the abuse of human rights, the oppression of dissidents, the imprisoning of political protesters, that has continued and has actually increased after the reapproachment was announced. So this is something that really there's no evidence to suggest that the Cuban government is ready for any significant change.
What do you think is the right approach for the U.S. government in terms of how it deals with Cuba?
Dialogue is important. I understand that. But I think you need to come with the table with the understanding that something needs to be done, that there needs to be serious concessions from the Castro regime. Because to me, it seems that the current setup treats Cuba like an equal partner in these talks, and it's not. It's a tyrannical communist regime who abuses its own people, who murders its own people. It's not someone that comes to the table on equal footing with a country like the United States that promotes freedom and democracy around the world.
Ariana Mendez is Cuban-American. Her grandfather worked for the Batista government, and her family was blacklisted in Cuba until they were able to emigrate in the 1980s. Thanks, Ariana.
Thank you.
From a business perspective, the current opening to Cuba could represent a unique opportunity. American engineers Saul Barenthal and Horace Clemens think it does. They see a bright future in Cuba, where farmers use inexpensive tractors to vastly increase their yields. And they want to make those tractors on the island.
A lot of people have said Saul and I are crazy that this wouldn't succeed.
That's Horace Clemens. He and his business partner are on their way to becoming the first Americans in more than 50 years to manufacture a product in Cuba. We reached Clemens at an agricultural fair in Havana, where he was showing off a prototype tractor to Cuban farmers.
What's special about it, it matches the environment that they're currently in with small family farms. The tractor really is designed to handle 40 to 80 acres, single row tractor. It's also designed so simply and durable that it can be fixed or repaired in the field. So if a farmer's planting a crop and the tractor breaks, he doesn't want to wait 7 days for a part. So everything we've done is designed to have interchangeable parts and have them be readily available and simple enough that it can be fixed in the field or a local shop.
And where are the parts made, Cuba or the U.S.?
Initially, we will be sourcing parts from different places, from the U.S., the goal long-term is to have Cuba source as many of the parts from Cuba as possible.
More than 500 American entrepreneurs have gone to Cuba in the past 15 months, and only two projects have received the blessings of Cuban authorities. One of them is yours. How did you succeed where so many other American businessmen and women have failed?
Well, when we started this, Saul, because he is Cuban and the many trips that he had made to Cuba since 2007, understood where they currently were. And so if you look at the model that we presented, we didn't try to come to Cuba to sell something. We came to Cuba to try to work with Cuba to help solve a problem. So we're really not selling something. We're establishing a manufacturing facility, and across the board it will help create more jobs in Cuba and help build the Cuban economy.
Horace, you've had a long and very successful career, first with IBM and then with a startup that you sold and made a lot of money off of. What's in this for you? Why are you doing this?
Saul and I have a relationship that goes back almost 45 years. His motivation is really to try to come back and contribute to Cuban society. I tell people that Saul is walking on the edge of history, and I am enjoying the ride. I believe our project will be successful because we take the time to explain to everybody that we talk to why we're doing this and how we want them to be a part of it.
Horace Clemens is a former IBM engineer. He and his business partner and friend Saul Barenthal are going to be starting a tractor manufacturing facility in Cuba, and we've been speaking to him at an agricultural fair in Havana. Thanks so much, Horace.
Okay, appreciate the time.
The Tractor Guys are just one of many American companies eyeing Cuba. Just this weekend, Starwood Hotels announced it had signed a deal to manage three hotels owned by the Cuban government. So U.S. businesses, large and small, are taking a gamble on Cuba's untapped potential. Tom Hudson is a special correspondent for WLRN in Miami on assignment in Havana this week. He says that tractor factory we just heard about could be a preview of what's to come in Cuba.
I think it's probably a small sign of the things the Cuban government wants to come. It's a tractor that Saul and Horace say will be assembled in Cuba if they're successful. Right now, they're negotiating with the Cuban government for essentially a land lease at the Port of Mariel and the special economic zone there, where new Cuban rules essentially allow 100% foreign-owned companies to come in and build factories. That's what this tractor represents for the Cuban government. It hopes it is the beginning of a flood of foreign investment that it wants to control, no doubt about it, but foreign investment that is badly needed here in Cuba.
And will these two Americans be able to hire Cubans to work at their tractor factory?
It remains unknown right now. That's one of those big questions that still has been unanswered. American companies have been confident, those that have been engaging in Cuba, that they will have the flexibility in labor that they are used to in other countries.
You know, from a distance, it seems like U.S. businesses that are so far striking deals are basically adapting to the needs of Cuba's centralized economy. What's really in this for U.S. businesses at this point?
I think that it is reputation. It is seeing themselves as a financial and economic pioneer more than profits, per se.
Tom, you've covered kind of U.S.-Cuba relations and the whole business relationship between the two, or the burgeoning business relationship. Anything really surprised you on this visit?
A couple of things surprised me here, Carol. One was we visited a non-farm cooperative of CPAs, of business consultants, of financial professionals and planners, of information technology consultants running out of the front salon of a hotel on Fifth Avenue in Havana. They're attracting partners. They expect to have over 200 partners of this cooperative, pushing the boundaries of what the Cuban government has allowed with these non-farm cooperatives. And in really a case of economic irony is that the biggest client of this non-farm cooperative is the Cuban government itself, as accountants and IT professionals who had been working for Cuban government entities are leaving those jobs, finding better opportunities, higher pay within this non-farm cooperative, this private enterprise that has been allowed only for a few years. They are now going to work as consultants for the former agencies at which they used to work.
Tom Hudson is in Havana. He's a special correspondent for WLRN in Miami, and he hosts a business program called the Sunshine Economy. Great to talk to you, Tom. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Carol, for the time.
Cuba and the U.S., united by baseball. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Pretty much every foreign leader who visits Havana lays a wreath at the tomb of Cuba's independence hero, José Martí. And that's what President Obama did today. The tomb is located in downtown Havana in iconic Revolution Square. Che Guevara and other revolutionary heroes are honored there as well, but the monument to José Martí towers above them all. So why is Martí such a big deal? Well, The World's history guy, Chris Wolfe, is here to fill us in. Chris, what's the answer?
Well, José Martí is revered by all Cubans as the kind of founding father of independence. Something like Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, and Thomas Paine, all rolled into one. Poet, writer, philosopher, and would-be warrior. He was, in a sense, kind of the intellectual architect of independence from the colonial power, Spain, back in the 19th century. He helped inspire a revolution in 1895 that helped win that freedom. He had a short life, but his collected works and writings fill more than 50 volumes. And it's not just, you know, political tracts. There's children's books and all kinds of interesting things. And what's really remarkable is that all Cubans revere him still, both the communist Castros and their bitter opponents among the émigrés in Miami, who named their propaganda station Radio Martí after him.
I was just going to mention Radio Martí. It is interesting to have someone celebrated by everyone along the political spectrum where Cuba's concerned. What is it about Martí that makes him appeal to all Cubans, regardless of their politics?
Well, he was a champion of certain common ideals. One is which was kind of freedom and independence, but also kind of a wariness of the United States as well. He did admire the United States. He did benefit from living here in exile for a few years and was grateful for that. But he was also worried that, like, the growing power of kind of Anglo-America was so great that it could easily come to, like, dominate Latin America. And he warned his fellow Cubans and other Latin Americans to be wary not to allow, like, U.S. domination to replace that of Spain. And in fact, that's pretty much what happened in 1898 when the U.S. went to war with Spain and seized control not only of Cuba, but also Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines. And so there was this kind of love-hate relationship that developed after that.
And Martí lived through that Spanish-American War?
Sadly, no. He died very young, of age 42, in 1895. He had a tremendous mind. He was a great thinker and an inspirational writer. But the one thing he failed at was soldiering. He sailed down to Cuba to join the revolution that he inspired against Spain. And he was accompanied by these experienced military men. And Martí felt that they looked down on him for his lack of experience and lack of military abilities. So one day when one of these experienced military men ordered a retreat, Martí decided to attack to prove his courage by himself, and he made a perfect target, well-dressed on a big white horse, and, you know, the Spanish just shot him down very quickly, just, as I say, just 42 years of age.
Chris, before we go, I hear you have a nugget about the Cuban War of Independence, and it has to do with Winston Churchill. What's that about?
Yeah, while I was reading about José Martí, I was astonished to find that in 1895, when Martí went to start the Cuban Revolution, that Winston Churchill was on the other side of that war a little later in that year. The first medal that Churchill ever got was from the King of Spain for his courage in action in Cuba. As a 21-year-old soldier, he took leave from his regiment in London to go work as a reporter, but ended up getting mixed up in the fighting in Cuba. And it was the first time he ever came under fire. And of course, being Churchill, he found it tremendously exhilarating, so it figures in his memoirs and biography, which is like, oh, I had no idea. And it was also where he fell in love with Cuban cigars. You know, every picture of Churchill has that big fat cigar. Well, that's where he fell in love with them. And also rum and siestas. He, you know, famously enjoyed his midday naps for the rest of his career. And it was in Cuba during the War of Independence that he first discovered and fell in love with the nap.
Amazing. The World's One-Man History Desk, Chris Wolfe. Thanks as always.
Thanks, Carol.
Finally today, let's talk baseball. Before he leaves Cuba tomorrow, President Obama is expected to attend a game between the Tampa Bay Rays and Cuba's national team. Baseball was introduced to Cuba by U.S. troops after the Spanish-American War of 1898. That's the word from Peter Kornblum. He directs the Cuba Documentation Project at George Washington University.
It was a game that the U.S. Marines started to teach Cuban kids. And baseball became a huge pastime in Cuba for many, many years. Even today, in the main square of downtown Cuba, there's a group of guys who gather every day to debate the various players, the various games. Cubans are fanatical for their baseball, just like Americans are fanatical for their baseball.
What's interesting is that, as you said, that fanaticism continued even after the revolution and after the U.S. and Cuba broke relations. The love for baseball flourished regardless.
Well, you know, Fidel Castro himself had a great love of baseball. He once thought he might become a professional baseball player, and the legend has it that he actually tried out for the New York Yankees. And he wanted to be a pitcher, and he certainly wasn't going to take baseball away from the Cuban people because he has himself a great love of baseball.
Peter, I was interested to read in one of your articles about baseball diplomacy and how it was first broached in 1975 when then Major League Baseball Commissioner Bowie Kuhn approached Secretary of State Henry Kissinger with an idea. What was it?
In the Major League Baseball, they thought, well, if we can have better relations with Cuba, we might be able to access some of those great Cuban players. And Bowie Kuhn approached Kissinger saying, look, why don't we take a U.S. team or an exhibition team down to Cuba for a few games? He started meeting with Cuban sports officials, and he reported to Kissinger not once, not twice, but three times that there was this tremendous interest in setting up a series of games and Cuba's interest in having its players be able to play in the major leagues. In terms of Kissinger's perspective, he understood that this could be like ping-pong diplomacy with China. It could help set the stage for normalization relations with Cuba, but that didn't quite work out in the 70s, and no team went until 1999 during the Clinton administration when the Baltimore Orioles finally got permission to go.
And what was the context for that? How come it happened in 99 and didn't in the mid-70s?
In the mid-1990s and late 1990s, the Clinton administration did want to move forward on better relations with Cuba, and the Clinton administration instituted a strategy of people-to-people contact. And a former Washington Post reporter, Scott Armstrong, and a filmmaker, Saul Landau, started to push this idea of the Baltimore Orioles going, and they convinced Peter Angelos, the owner of the Baltimore Orioles, that this would be great for his team. They then brought in top White House officials to games at Camden Yards and lobbied them, and eventually the administration said yes, and the Baltimore Orioles went down in March of 1999. I was on the plane.
And of course, then in 2002, Jimmy Carter goes to Havana. He throws out the first pitch. Incredible game. So bringing it up to today, as you've mentioned, there's going to be a game on this trip between Tampa Bay Rays and the Cuban national team in Havana. Do you expect Obama to throw out the first pitch?
I would hope that President Obama throws out the first pitch if the whole issue of his security can be worked out, which I think it can be. The Cubans will love it. I think American citizens will love it. And it'll show once again that, you know, the baseball diamond can be common ground for our two countries along with all the other issues we have.
Peter Kornbluh directs the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Carol.
We'll have more coverage of the president's historic visit to Cuba tomorrow, right here on The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.